I want to thank you so much for being with us, Victoria Elliott, reporter for Wired. One other question. Are they downloading this information? Do we know what they're doing inside these agencies, these 19, 20-year-old kids, kids who call themselves big balls, kids who talk about normalizing Indian hate? Are they downloading the private health and financial information of millions of people in this country?
We don't know, and the lack of transparency is what's concerning. My colleagues have also reported that, you know, my colleagues, McKenna Kelly also reported, you know, that it does seem that they want to lean more, that DOGE as a sort of mission wants to lean more heavily into AI and automating systems. And, you know, it would follow, although we don't know, that that kind of data would be needed to train an automated system. But again, we don't know. And that is, you know, a big part of the issue is just the lack of transparency.
Victoria Elliott, we thank you so much for being with us. Reporter for Wired, she and her team have broken a number of major stories on Elon Musk and DOGE. We'll link to them. Victoria's recent headline, the recruitment effort that helped build Elon Musk's DOGE army. Next up, in addition to heading DOGE, the South African-born richest man in the world, Elon Musk, is claiming white South Africans have been the victims of racist ownership laws. New U.S. government, Trump administration, has just announced they're cutting off all aid to South Africa. Stay with us.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight? Last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming.
The musical legend John Batiste singing the Star Spangled Banner at the start of the Super Bowl Sunday night. His performance came just days after President Trump fired him and others from serving on the board of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In the audience at the Super Bowl was President Trump, the first president to attend a Super Bowl. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump ordered a freeze on all foreign aid to South Africa in an executive order Friday, claiming South Africa's white populations facing, quote, government-sponsored race-based discrimination. Trump has repeatedly criticized the new land reform law in South Africa, where the country's white minority still owns the vast majority of farmland 30 years after the end of apartheid rule. Trump wrote on his Truth Social account Sunday, South Africa's confiscating land and treating certain classes of people very badly, unquote. Trump has made the claim before. The South African government says it's part of a, quote, campaign of misinformation and propaganda, unquote. His order also claims South African leaders have, quote, taken aggressive positions toward the U.S. and its allies, citing its pursuit of genocide claims against Israel before the International Court of Justice. South Africans responded to the freeze of an estimated $440 million in U.S. aid. This is a woman seeking her regular treatment for HIV/AIDS when she realized the clinic was closed. She spoke with Sky News Africa correspondent Yusra Albaghi.
Are you trying to go to the clinic?
Yeah.
It's closed.
What happened?
I mean, the USAID funding has been frozen, so they're closing down clinics. Do you have alternatives?
I don't know. I'm going to ask next door. Hopefully, they'll be able to assist me. If they can't, I don't know. I don't know what to do. Serious. What will I do? There's nothing.
Trump's order also offered refugee status in the United States to white South Africans, Afrikaners, who are, quote, victims of unjust racial discrimination. But many in the right-wing white lobby groups say they want to stay and focus on ending black majority rule. All of this comes as the South African-born billionaire, the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, now a leader in Trump's administration, has said white South Africans have been the victims of, quote, racist ownership laws and accused the post-apartheid government of anti-white racism. Last week, Musk's 78-year-old father, Errol Musk, said an advisor to South African President Cyril Ramaphosa asked him to help.
I was asked if I can arrange a quick talk between Ramaphosa and Elon last night. So I said, all right, so I did. And then they spoke a few minutes later, and it's on my phone. I can only imagine that Elon would have said, look, we want to help you, but you have to quit this war on white people in South Africa.
Errol Musk is Elon Musk's father. Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, has increasingly embraced far-right leaders and conspiracy theaters that some link to his roots in apartheid-era South Africa. In a minute, we'll also look at how Musk is part of the PayPal mafia of libertarian billionaires with roots in South Africa under white rule, who now hold powerful positions in the tech industry and politics and surround the White House. But we begin in Johannesburg with Trevor Ngwane, Soweto-based activist and chair of the United Front, umbrella body of community and labor organizations. Welcome back, Trevor, to Democracy Now! Talk about the effects of this immediate cutting off of all U.S. aid to South Africa, your country.
Thank you, Emmy. Yeah, it's terrible because remember that there's a lot of programs here which rely on American funding, primarily the HIV program, PEPFAR. 17% of the programs are funded by money from America. And with one stroke, all that those services were stopped because no money came through and millions of people are suffering, including other community, social and health programs. So this is very bad for the people here in South Africa.
I mean, it's very interesting you mentioned PEPFAR. Let's remember that it was established by the former Republican president of the United States, George W. Bush, what many call perhaps the most important achievement of his presidency. The significance when you talk, Trevor, looking back at the end of apartheid in 94, white South Africans who make up, what, 7% of the population, owning farms that make up about half of South Africa. What are your thoughts on the information or misinformation we're getting in the United States about land seizures from Donald Trump and from the South African-born Elon Musk?
Well, white people, you know, are sitting pretty. They managed to hang on to most of their wealth due to global and local economic processes. The rich continue to get richer and the poor get poorer. Most of the white, of the farmland, more than 70% of it is owned by white farmers. So basically, they're sitting pretty. You know, they've got nothing to complain about. Perhaps, Amy, you know, there's a saying, the guilty are afraid. Perhaps they know that this unjust situation where a tiny minority enjoys, you know, most of the country's wealth and resources is not tenable. And sooner or later, it will have to end.
And finally, Trevor, President Trump welcoming Afrikaner refugees into the United States as flight after flight takes immigrants from the United States, for example, to Guantanamo.
Yeah, well, the white people here are not interested in going to the USA because they're having a good life here. The only thing that is bothering them is what I can call white fears in the face of black aspirations. Indeed, black frustrations, because after 30 years of democracy, not much has changed in terms of, you know, wealth ownership, in terms of basic improvement in the everyday lives of the people. White people, they are human beings. They can see that the suffering continues. They're just guilty. And they know that they should part, give away some of their wealth, but they are not prepared. So they are using politics, ideology, misinformation, and propaganda, some of them, you know, to maintain the status quo.
Trevor Ngwane is joining us from Johannesburg, South Africa. I want to bring into this conversation Chris McGreal. He was the Johannesburg correspondent for The Guardian during the last years of apartheid until 2002. His new piece for The Guardian is titled, What Does Elon Musk Believe? And How the Roots of the PayPal Mafia Extend to Apartheid South Africa. This is really illuminating, Chris. Who are the PayPal Mafia, and how are they linked to apartheid-era South Africa?
Well, they're a group of men who are at the top, the founding of PayPal, all of whom in some way or other grew up in South Africa as children. You've got Musk himself, who was born in South Africa and lived there, went to high school there until he was 18 and then moves to Canada. You've got Peter Thiel, who was a co-founder with Musk of PayPal. Thiel was born in Germany but brought to South Africa as a young child. His father was a mining engineer. Lived in Johannesburg and then moved to Southwest Africa, which was then a South African colony, is now Namibia. And he went to school in Swakopmund, which was notorious as probably the last place on the planet where people still openly greeted each other with Heil Hitler and celebrated Hitler's birthday. He went to a German school there before moving to the United States when he was 10 or 11. You've got David Sacks, who was born in Cape Town. He's big in PayPal and is now Trump's AI and crypto czar. He moved to Tennessee as a relatively young child, but grew up in the white South African diaspora there. And you've got Rolf Botha, who was the son of Pik Botha, the grandson of Pik Botha, the last foreign minister of apartheid South Africa. He was the acceptable face of apartheid. You'll remember he used to run around the United States trying to put a gloss on how they were reforming things and that everything was getting better, which apparently it wasn't. But so you see those four key people at the top of PayPal, and they all have this, you know, very intimate connection to South Africa.
So we just played Errol Musk. That's Elon Musk's father. Talk about what the significance of what he said and also how he gained his wealth in South Africa and when these men left South Africa.
So, well, Errol Musk still lives in South Africa,
yeah,
which is why, of
their
course,
kids.
He's... Yes, the Errol Musk made his money in lots of different ways, but the main way was he had investments in emerald mines in Zambia, and he became extremely wealthy. Now, the conditions on those mines were notoriously bad, as they were on mines throughout sort of southern Central Africa. He made a lot of money from that, so much so that when Musk's mother divorces him, there's listed a jet, a yacht, several houses in the divorce settlement. So he was extremely, extremely rich. Musk himself, he stayed in South Africa till he was 18. He goes to school first in Johannesburg and ends up at Pretoria Boys High, which is a largely racially exclusive all-white school near Pretoria, which is the capital. There was a quirk of it in which there were some black students. I think the first black student in the school was the son of a foreign diplomat, but the diplomat came from one of the black homelands that only South Africa recognized as independent, part of the apartheid structures. Musk has a Canadian passport through his mother, because Musk's mother's father was, mother's parents were Canadian. And there's a whole story there. I mean, Errol Musk regarded himself as an anti-apartheid liberal. He joined the Progressive Federal Party, which was ostensibly against apartheid, but he leaves it when it starts supporting one person, one vote. He actually doesn't believe in that. Musk's grandfather, Canadian grandfather, had been the head of the Canadian branch of a political movement in the 1930s called Technocracy Incorporated, which in essence wanted to scrap democracy in the United States and Canada and have technocrats rule the country, which might sound familiar. That becomes a de facto fascist party, is banned during the Second World War, and then the grandfather moves to apartheid South Africa, having had no connection to the place, in 1950, because he likes the sound of apartheid. And even Errol Musk says of the grandfather, he was an open neo-Nazi.
This is Errol Musk's father, Errol, on Podcast and Chill with Mac G, discussing Elon Musk's mother's father, Joshua Haldeman, alleging he supported Nazis and South Africa's apartheid.
Her parents, by the way, were very fanatical in favor of apartheid. This is quite interesting. Mm. Her parents came to South Africa from Canada because they sympathized with the Afrikaner government. They used to support Hitler and all that sort of stuff. Mm-mm. But they didn't know, obviously, I don't think they knew what the Germans were, the Nazis were doing. But they in Canada, they were in the German party in Canada, and they sympathized with the Germans.
Yeah.
So when the Afrikaners government came into power here in 1948, then May's father, who was quite an interesting guy, he was a very good pilot. He said he wants to be with the Afrikaners because he agrees with apartheid.
So again, that's Errol Musk, Elon Musk's father, as we begin to wrap up this discussion. If you can talk about what has just happened, the power of the PayPal mafia now in determining perhaps that the U.S. would cut off all aid to South Africa and accept Afrikaners as refugees to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty astonishing. It really is. But it's really rooted in something that goes back a few years, which is a campaign by white Afrikaner farmers through an organization called AfriForum, which were very active here during the first Trump term. They came in 2018, met John Bolton and others, and they were very much pushing the idea of a white genocide in South Africa. And really, it's a continuation of that campaign. AfriForum has been at the forefront of the idea that Afrikaners are the victims of the end of apartheid, that Afrikaners are the people who have really suffered in South Africa. And it's now come to this point where, absurdly, it's being proposed that they have refugee status.
Finally, were you surprised by Elon Musk's Nazi-like or Nazi salute when he was addressing people at a Trump rally?
Well, given that it was instantly recognized for what it was, yes. I even by Elon Musk's standards, I thought, wow. I wasn't surprised that he then tries to pretend it wasn't what it was, and he comes up with all kinds of other explanations. But I think almost everybody that watched that instantly went, oh, we know what that is, and assumed that Elon knew what it was as well.
Chris McGreal, longtime Johannesburg correspondent for The Guardian, will link to his piece, How the Roots of the PayPal Mafia Extend to Apartheid South Africa. And we'll do part two of this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Next up, as Trump doubles down on plans to own Gaza, we go to the occupied West Bank, where Israel's intensified its military assault. Back in 20 seconds.
Till earth and heaven ring with the harmony of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening sky. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea.
Sing
Lift Every Voice and Sing, performed by Sister Murray Knight. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in the occupied West Bank as Israel's intensifying its military assault, which has displaced 35,000 Palestinians in recent weeks. On Saturday, Israeli troops raided the Nur Shams refugee camp, where they killed two women, including one who is 8 months pregnant, her husband critically injured. Palestinian health officials said efforts to save the woman's fetus failed in part because the Israeli military prevented the couple from being transferred to the hospital. This comes as President Trump's doubled down on his proposal for the United States to own Gaza and forcibly displace Palestinians living there. For more, we go to Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, where we're joined by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian physician, activist, politician who serves as General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. He's been a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council since 2006. Dr. Barghouti, welcome back to Democracy Now! There's so much to discuss and so little time. If you can start off by talking about President Trump's proposal, clearly not off the cuff as he was reading and has doubled down almost every day on saying the U.S. will own Gaza and the millions of Palestinians who live there should go elsewhere. In fact, he's talked about Jordan, he's talked about Egypt, and the Jordanian king is coming to the White House tomorrow to meet with Trump.
I think what President Trump announced is nothing but an advocacy of two major war crimes. And what he said should be described as it is, very, very clearly. He is calling for ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people of Gaza, which is an act of war. It's an act, it's a criminal, it's a war crime. And second, he's calling for theft of Gaza from its owners, from the Palestinian people who live in Gaza, who lived there for more than 4,000 years, who own the place, who have their civilization there, their houses used to be there, their whole life was there. And he wants to simply ethnically cleanse them and then take away the land from them. I wonder how would President Trump respond if somebody suggested that all people of New York should be evicted to Afghanistan, for instance, so that somebody else can take their land and create a constructive project there. Something has to be clear. Palestinians will not leave their country. Israel tried to ethnically cleanse all Palestinians during a horrible genocide, which lasted for 15 months, killing more than 70,000 Palestinians, including 17,000 children. And they failed because Palestinians stuck to their land and they are not planning to leave anywhere.
Can you talk about what you think the king, the Jordanian king, should say when he meets with Trump tomorrow, or what you understand he's going to say?
Well, as you have seen, not only Jordan, but Egypt as well, and Saudi Arabia, and all Arab countries were very angry at what Trump said. And Egypt and Jordan made it very clear that there is that they will not cooperate in this crime of ethnic cleansing against the Palestinian people. I think the Jordanian king will tell President Trump several things. First of all, that his people, the people of Jordan, will never accept that the regime would cooperate in any act of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. Second, that a new transfer of Palestinians to Jordan will simply mean the end of Jordan as a Hashemite kingdom. This will mean the end of the place completely, and it would fulfill what Netanyahu and his crowd, his fascist crowd, are calling for, which is let Jordan be the Palestinian state and simply evict all Palestinians, not only from Gaza, but also from the West Bank. And thirdly, I think President Trump will try to pressure the king by threatening to cut down the foreign aid to Jordan and maybe use other methods of pressure. But the king has leverage here, which will be the summit of the Arab countries. And we've been calling on all Arab countries to do three things. First of all, to issue a very clear position rejecting Trump's plan of conducting a new war crime against the Palestinian people. Second, that they should establish some sort of a safety net for both Jordan and Egypt if they are subjected to manipulations from Trump, from President Trump. And third, that all Arab countries must provide every support they can to Palestinians to help their steadfastness, not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank, since the Israeli army is already conducting ethnic cleansing of Jenin refugee camp, of Tul Karim refugee camp, of Nur Shams refugee camp, and practically it has moved the war from Gaza to the West Bank.
So talk about what's happening right now in the West Bank. Just in the last few weeks, we're talking about tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians. I'm not talking about Gaza, right? We're talking about the West Bank. Explain more about what's happening in Nur Shams and Jenin. Talk about the 8-month-old pregnant woman who was killed by the Israeli military.
What the Israelis are doing in the West Bank is nothing but another war crime. They've already, in addition to arresting 12,500 people since October 7th, during the last month, January alone, the Israeli army arrested 580 more Palestinians, many of whom will be put under administrative detention because they cannot charge them with anything. And most importantly, the Israeli army initiated a military operation in the north of the West Bank, which has affected up till now 4 major refugee camps. In Jenin camp, they've already destroyed more than 150 homes and houses, and they are now, and they've evicted 20,000 people who are the whole inhabitants of the refugee camp. They evicted them out of the camp, conducting an act of ethnic cleansing. 80% of the people in Tul Karim refugee camp have also been evicted, the same in Nur Shams refugee camp. And now there is a huge attack since 9 days on Al Far'a refugee camp in Tubas area. So we are talking here about a terrible military campaign with destruction of infrastructure, destruction of houses. Footage that comes out of Jenin actually shows us something very similar to the destruction and damage that was caused in many parts of Gaza. But more than that, more than 80 people have been killed since the initiation of this operation. About one third of them are children and women. And the last woman who was killed was 8 months pregnant. She was 8 months pregnant. She tried with her husband and two of their children to get out of the camp, to get medical, to go to a clinic to get medical consultation, because she was worried about her pregnancy. And when they were trying to leave the camp, the Israeli soldiers saw them and shot them. The father was critically injured. The mother was very seriously injured. An ambulance managed to get to them, transported them. When they were in front of the main governmental hospital, the Israeli army stopped the ambulance for 30 minutes, and that woman bled to death, and her child died too because of her bleeding. And the most horrifying thing is that the two other children watched the horror of the death of their mother and the injury of their father. This is the kind of what the Israeli, the kind of thing that the Israeli army is doing, not only in Jenin, in Tul Karim refugee camps, but also in Jenin and in other places. But the whole West Bank, Amy, is now under attack because Israel has imposed on this little area no less than 920 military checkpoints and gates. What does a gate mean? It means that the army comes into a village or a town and put a gate in front of the main road to that place. They shut off all other roads, and then they close the gate and leave, which means these villages become prisons, small prisons where everybody is stuck, cannot go to their work, cannot go to for medical care if they need it, cannot go for their education in schools or universities. This is the kind of life we live in. And now transportation in the West Bank is totally obstructed because a trip that usually takes 40 minutes could take 5 hours. Sometimes it is totally impossible. On Saturdays, almost the whole West Bank is shut off. So It's a real situation of war, and everything is affected. Trade is affected, economy is affected, medical care is affected. We are unable to reach many people who need our health care.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti is a medical doctor as well as an activist and a politician who serves as general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. We thank you so much for being with us from Israeli-occupied West Bank, from Ramallah. Dr. Mustafa has been a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council since 2006. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.